Hello and welcome to the Russian Empire History Podcast, the history of all the peoples of the Russian Empire. I'm your host, J.P. Bristow. This is Season 1, The Forest, The Steppe, and The Birth of the Russian Empire, and Episode 51, Life in Rus. Before we begin, Stjofan sent a message through Spotify, and since there doesn't seem to be a way to respond there, I'll answer here. Stjofan says, "There are so many paid Patreon episodes now. It was never like this when you started." I guess it is indeed true that before I was doing member episodes, there were no member episodes, and now I am doing them, they gradually accumulate. But I would like to reassure Stjofan and anyone else who's concerned that the main narrative will always be here in the free podcast. The member episodes cover additional supplementary subjects, things that I think are interesting or that don't fit into the main narrative. For instance, we're currently looking at the history of Central Asia. The Russian conquest of Central Asia mostly takes place in the mid-19th century. If I waited until we got there, it would be rather an interruption to say, "So, who are the people of Bukhara?" and then jump back 2,000 years. And not everyone wants that level of detail, interesting as it may be. So subjects like that will be covered in the members' episodes for those who do want the detail. I realise some people may just dislike the paywall altogether, but podcasting has costs and takes a lot of time, and the only real options we have to cover those costs are advertising, sponsorships, and subscriptions. If anyone's interested in sponsoring the show, please get in touch. Until then, thank you once again to everyone who has subscribed through Patreon, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or PayPal. Your support is greatly appreciated. Anyway, on with the show. Greetings to Onfim from Anna. "My lord brother, look after my case against Constantine. Declare to him before witnesses. Because you brought a claim against my sister and against her daughter, and called my sister a cow and her daughter a whore, now Boris has returned, and hearing that accusation, he drove my sister out and tried to kill her. Then, my lord brother, tell him this. You brought this accusation, and now you must prove it. If Constantine says that I swore surety for my son-in-law, tell him this. If there are witnesses against my sister who say that she swore surety for her son-in-law, I will be responsible to you for it. So, brother, investigate any accusation or claim against me, and if there are witnesses to it, then I am not your sister or my husband's wife." This letter was written on birch bark and found preserved in clay excavations in Novgorod. The first was found in 1951, since when over 1,000 such manuscripts have been found. The absolute majority were found in Novgorod, but we also have a smaller number from other old towns, Smolensk, Tver, Ryazan, from Palatsk and Vitebsk in modern Belarusk, and from Volhynia. Even though the absolute majority of the messages were found in Novgorod, the only reason for this is that they have been preserved by a waterlogged layer of clay that forms an anaerobic preservation chamber. There's every reason to think that they are representative of use across Rus. For a start, many of them are actually letters to or from people in other parts of Rus, which, even if they are from Novgorodians away from town, shows that there was a system in place for delivering them. Their content is entirely quotidian, showing that the writers saw writing these messages as an everyday practice. So even if the first one to be found in, say, Moscow, only turned up when making some repairs to the entry to Red Square in the late 80s, this just means that the local conditions in other parts of Rus were not as conducive to their preservation as they are in Novgorod. The manuscripts date from the 11th to 14th centuries and are one of the best pieces of evidence that we have of what life in Rus was like, because they are mostly written by ordinary people about day-to-day things, some personal, some business, and in a vernacular language, sometimes including obscenities, rather than the old church Slavonic-influenced language of ecclesiastical texts. Almost all the texts are in this vernacular, with a handful in old church Slavonic, one in Old Norse, and one in an archaic form of Karelian, which is the oldest known text in a Finnic language. They were written by scratching the characters into the birch bark with a stylus, of which more than 200 have been found, usually iron, but sometimes bronze or bone. Because they are written by ordinary people, what they are about can tell us about their lives. In this letter from Anna to her brother Onfim, the first thing we see is that Anna is either literate or had access to someone who would write a letter that she dictated, and the same for her brother. She is mixed up in something with a man named Konstantin, who has accused her and her daughter of sexual impropriety, a very serious charge for a woman in medieval Rus, grounds for divorce and other punishments. Anna asserts that the claim, which her husband appears to believe is true, is false, and perhaps linked to Konstantin also claiming that she guaranteed a debt of her son-in-law. By saying that if he can find any witnesses, she will agree to responsible, Anna would also appear to be denying that she ever guaranteed any such debt. Regardless of the facts of this individual case, this suggests that women had standing to enter into deals like this, and that therefore they had some kind of control over their own property, which she would need to be able to give any guarantee. Anna informing her brother that Konstantin has brought a claim against her and asking him to act for her shows that there was some form of dispute resolution available. But because her husband has listened to Konstantin's allegations and thrown her out, she is forced to ask her brother to defend her. So, even if she was able to act as a surety for a debt, she appears to have lacked the standing to properly defend herself, and needed the protection of her male next of kin, a husband, brother, or father. However, we can also see that a man's mere word is not enough to convict her. She demands that he provide proof and witnesses, if he can find them, to back up his claim. Finally, although she requires a man, her brother, to act for her, she feels quite comfortable instructing him exactly how to go about it, and her letter comes off as rather assured, not in the slightest obsequious. One of the best-known authors of birch bark manuscripts was a boy named Onfim, at least that is the standard Russian version of his name. Recall last episode I mentioned that Novgorod had its own dialect, a form of East Slavic that was diverging from the dialect that would go on to form Russian. Most of our knowledge of this old Novgorodian comes from these birch bark manuscripts, which are mostly written in the Novgorodian dialect. He wrote his name as Onfime, a Christian name derived from Anthemius. 17 of Onfime's birch bark manuscripts have now been found. He wrote them when he was 6 or 7 years old, while he was learning how to write. Most of them are writing exercises with some drawings. There is a picture of a knight on a horse stabbing someone on the ground with a lance, and his name written next to it. We, of course, guessed that this was him daydreaming about growing up to be a hero. He also drew a fire-breathing dragon with the text, "I am a wild beast," and a message, "Greetings from Onfimi to Danilo." The exercises include the alphabet, common syllables, and lines from the Psalms. It's easy to see the universal experiences of childhood in these 800-year-old texts. Most of the texts show us similar scenes from everyday life. There are inventories of dowries, a necklace, earrings, sheepskin coats, 3 embroidered ribbons with a headdress, 6 sponges, a feather bed and pillows, 5 dark dresses and 3 white dresses, a pot of honey, a washstand, and a chest. There are short prayers asking for blessings in childbirth and sickness, protection on the road, or success in business dealings. 3 nines of angels, 3 nines of archangels, deliver the servant of God Clement from the ague by the prayers of the Holy Mother of God. There are messages to family members traveling or living in another village. Greetings from Smin to my daughter-in-law. If you have not already remembered, you have malt. There is rye malt in the cellar that you can take. There is plenty of meal for bread. Take what you need. The meat is in the hayloft. From Stepan to my wife, Olisava. Sell the house and come here to Smolensk or Kiev. Bread is cheaper. If you don't come, send me a letter saying you are well. And messages to lovers. May your heart and body and soul burn for me and for my body and for the sight of me. Against our lack of literary sources from the period, these manuscripts really stand out for how relatable they are. Maybe the religious stuff is unfamiliar, but the sentiments and concerns are just the same ordinary human problems that have been throughout history, and we can easily imagine the writer and their situation. You'll remember that we've heard several times that we have little evidence of literacy in Rus. There are probably more mentions of people reading or writing books in the tale than we have actual books that have survived. And most of what we have is ecclesiastical, and therefore by definition of limited use in telling us about people's lives. This makes these little birch bark notes even more important. You've probably noticed that they sound like people talking. That is, they reflect oral rather than literary culture. If we think about what went on over the period the manuscripts reflect, we can make the assumption that the relationship between spoken and written language was changing. In the 11th century, the time of the earliest finds, literacy was still new and probably rare. People would naturally have written as they spoke, rather than following literary conventions, which take time to appear. By the latest finds from the 16th century, writing had certainly become more common. This means that historians can use the birch bark notes to try to detect various phenomena. They can look at whether they become more bookish over time, or whether they support the idea of a native literary language developing alongside the ecclesiastical one for discussing worldly subjects. These trends do not have to only go in one direction. If you think about some of the events that go on over this period, the Mongol conquest, the Baltic Crusades, the plague, not to mention other natural disasters, floods, famines that were always occurring, you'll see that there can also be periods where literacy declines. While the oldest birch bark texts date from around the time of the Christianization of Rus, scholars are still debating the relationship between ecclesiastical and secular writing. The first point is that we can set a starting date for ecclesiastical writing, more or less. We can't say the same for secular writing. Some scholars argue that there was already a native Slavic script in use in the pre-Christian period, which leads to arguments about where it came from and when. Their opponents dismissed the evidence these scholars rely on as the result of wrong dating or not being actual Slavic writing, and proposed that the Rus only started writing after their conversion. One such scholar, Alexei Gippius, describes the birch bark manuscripts as a convergence of writing as a fundamental attribute of Christian culture and the oral practices of everyday urban life. This naturally gives rise to their great variety. Quote, "The use of Cyrillic script for practical purposes left plenty of room for variation on different levels. Much depended here on the competence and literary ambitions of a scribe. The handwriting may be professional or amateur. Orthography may be the same as that of the church manuscripts or deviate from it. And the language may be pure Old Novgorod dialect or the standardized version, avoiding local features as non-prestigious. And last but not least, vocabulary and phraseology may or may not be influenced by Church Slavonic." End quote. Given our lack of sources, we will probably never be able to determine whether writing appeared in Rus independently of the Church. But we can see some features in the manuscripts that show that people were literate. For instance, their organization, formulation, and information density. As you've heard in the examples that I read out, they start with an address and end with some kind of formula. Over time, these greetings become more expressive, which scholars link to the development of social differentiation. Spelling mistakes are rare. The most common subject is money. People sent notes reminding their wives to collect a debt, asking for money or goods to be sent, or to inform the recipient of a deal that they needed to carry out. Lists of inventory, prices, and debts are another common category. Sometimes there are notes about disputes. A man might write to the local authorities to complain that his brother's debt was collected from him, even though he did not act as a guarantor for his brother. The notes refer to amounts, hryvnia, or other units, kunas, veverices, nagatas, and rezanas, which were all based on a silver standard, which was in turn based on those Islamic silver dirhams that had flowed up the trade routes from Central Asia. You might recall me mentioning that this flow of silver had dwindled away by this time, and we also don't have any evidence for large inflows of Western European or Byzantine coinage. The Rus never minted much coinage of their own. There were some prestige pieces produced by rulers looking to assert their independence and legitimacy, but by the 12th century, actual coins were so rare it gets referred to as the coinless period. Silver was used as a medium of exchange in the form of ingots. Coins were melted down and lumps of silver were traded at the value of their weight. From those units that I mentioned, hryvnia typically referred to metal. When we say the druzhina, out collecting tribute, brought 300 hryvnia from some town or city, it usually means that they brought that weight in silver. But outside of high-value transactions, other things were used. Veverica and kuna were squirrel and marten skins. Like silver, they also came to have a standard value. One hryvnia was equal to 25 kunas, or 150 veverices. Other items like glass beads or spindle walls also had a standard value. So when people wrote asking for payment or listing debts, they were talking about an exchange of these items rather than money. Although the church was against usury, references to interest are common. The standard rate was called at a third, charged annually, and meant, for example, that if you borrowed 10 hryvnia, you would have to repay 15 hryvnia a year later. If you recall our discussion of the Ruskaya Pravda, the first version, the short Pravda, contained rules governing the liability for physical injury and how the druzhina should behave. Revisions to the Pravda by Vladimir Monomakh and Svyatopolk added lending rules, requiring, for example, that witnesses be present to make a loan of more than 3 hryvnias valid. An order of seniority was established for the creditors of a debtor unable to pay. Lenders from out of town had the first claim, locals came second. If the debtor's property was insufficient, he could be sold into slavery and the proceeds distributed to his creditors. By the 12th century, Rus was getting richer. Churches, palaces, fortresses, and other public spaces were being built. Building them expanded the skilled artisan class. Growing cities needed supplies, which increased the merchant class. In short, there was economic growth everywhere, and that, in turn, meant more people with money and property and more demand for protection of their rights and interests. While this meant that the rulers of Rus did become more involved in the lives of their subjects, increasing taxation and regulation, the birch bark letters show us that most relationships, commerce, and disputes continued to be governed by custom and arbitrated by customary means, rather than by official representatives of the authorities. Economic development creates social stratification, but Rus society was not radically changed. If you are from the English or French-speaking world, you probably think about the Middle Ages in terms of feudalism and centralization. That is, a pyramid of reciprocal obligations of service and protection, from the ruler at the top down to the peasants at the base, with society divided into estates, the nobility, clergy, and peasantry. Neither estates nor a system of reciprocal obligations between different social classes existed in Rus. We'll get into whether or how much it ever exists in Eastern Europe later on in the show. In the Soviet historiography, these societies do get called feudal, because in the Marxist dogma, feudalism was a necessary stage in social development. But the institutions of Western European feudalism are missing. This links back to the discussions about the role of the Vietche and whether Novgorod was a republic that were raised in the Q&A episode, because if there were no estates, there could be no representation of those estates either. The basic secular social unit was the extended family, living in a dvor, a compound that could include workshops and land for growing food, as well as living space. There is some archaeological evidence to suggest that craftsmen of a particular type may have clustered together, but we have no evidence for a collective identity or organization. There is no evidence for trade guilds, for instance. Society consisted of boyars, the nobility, muži, the freemen, and ľudí gradskí, the townspeople. The rest, referred to as the prostata chad, the simple folk, were workers for hire, zakupy or rydavici, and finally there were slaves, cholopi. The freemen and the townspeople had the right to participate in the vetcher, which was essentially a gathering in the town square. The chronicles do not provide us with a consistent picture of the vetcher, and there were probably local variations in the relevant customs and procedures. As Franklin and Shepherd state, quote, One should probably not ascribe a fixed and formal constitutional role to the Vecce during this period. Vecce was a generic word for the means of mobilizing urban opinion, a periodic event rather than an institution of government. End quote. Neither was there any significant administration of the king's justice, a key element in the development of governance in the West. The birchbark letters show that people did not ask the prince or judges for protection or enforcement. They relied on customs, witnesses and public oaths, or guarantors. The oaths and proceedings themselves were not recorded. The system was self-regulating. The Pravda provided some rules that tell us about the status of women. There were some basic protections. Their parents were liable if a girl harmed herself when forced into a marriage that she did not want, but it was assumed that the parents would decide who a girl would marry. A woman could inherit only if she had no brothers, but her dowry was supposed to be her property. It was intended to provide a cushion if she ended up needing to take care of herself for some reason. But, as you might imagine, it could be difficult for a woman to keep her property separate from her husband, and that could leave a woman vulnerable. In one of the birchbark letters, a woman asks for help because her husband has taken all of her property and abandoned her for a new wife. As Christianity deepened its presence in Rus, this situation might have become somewhat rarer. The church was strongly concerned with enforcing monogamy and preventing divorce, especially men abandoning their wives. Rules appeared banning men from throwing out wives that were sick, another situation that we find described in the birchbark messages. Thinking back to the letter that we heard at the beginning, Anna's accuser could have been fined for making allegations of impropriety against another man's wife and daughter. A man could also be fined for beating another man's wife, but a husband could beat his own. These rules around marriage were enforced by the church, and complainants could take their case to the bishop. In the dangerous world of the Middle Ages, as many as 20% of women could find themselves widowed while still young. The family property passed to the children. If they were still minors, the widow held it in trust for them. A widow who was not young enough to remarry could end up entirely dependent on charity, which was also encouraged by the church. Although numerous birchbark letters to or from women list debts or purchases, we do not know about how or whether the women of Rus were involved in the production of goods. Some spindle walls have been found with women's names engraved on them, so it's quite likely that a household's women produced cloth, often women's work in other societies, but we have no indication whether they did so for sale or only for the family's own needs. If we go back to the only story of a woman that we have had so far, Olga of Kiev, we can see that even though we know the whole purpose of the story was propagandizing Vladimir's role in the conversion of Rus, it still fits within this framework of women's lives in Rus. She receives marriage proposals, conducts her husband's funeral, raises her children, and guards the realm for when they come of age. She is not presented as a ruler in her own right. There can be no question that women were second-class citizens in Rus. In Vladimir Monomakh's instruction to his sons, he wrote, "Love your wife, but do not give her power over you." Although we can find this kind of patriarchal society almost everywhere, Rus was even more male-dominated than Western Europe or Byzantium. As noted many times, the chronicles do not even bother to name women, let alone tell us what they did. While in other contemporary societies we have the occasional outstanding woman, Anna Komnena, Hildegard of Bingen, or Hrotswita, who manages to break through the barriers, in Rus we have neither writing about women nor writing by women. You're already familiar with the idea that one of the main causes for this is that nearly all our surviving sources were written by monks living in male communities. However, this is not just an issue of celibacy as such. We have a number of stories of monks or aspiring monks undergoing temptations that make it clear that the ascetic life is about rejecting family, not just sex. In these stories, mothers trying to get their sons to live worldly lives in the family home are almost as common as would-be wives out to seduce them. The women are not necessarily portrayed as evil. Sometimes they are even sympathetic, but they are an obstacle to the spiritual life. Despite this ascetic ideal, and certainly without suggesting that the average monk did not indeed live a life of self-denial, the monasteries of Kiev were well on their way to getting rich. It was no accident that the rioting citizens of Kiev raided them along with the homes of merchants and high officials. The rulers of Kiev invested large sums from the tribute they received into building monasteries and churches, and they were not the only ones. The knyazes of other towns also sponsored the building of churches in Kiev and its surrounds. In contrast to the initial decades after conversion, we see little major religious construction in Chernihiv, Novgorod, or elsewhere. Kiev is clearly the ecclesiastical capital. The leading monasteries acquired their substantial wealth through donations and legacies. The Monastery of the Caves owned donated land all over Rus. Those who did not give land donated precious artifacts like gold bookbindings or frames for icons, food, and other commodities. The monastery was recognized as a serious economic player and borrowed money from Kievan merchants to commission icons from Constantinople. When land was donated, it usually came together with the peasants who worked it, sometimes entire villages. The monastery enjoyed all the income from working or hunting on this land, not just the tithe. With time, the amount of land held by the monasteries will become a serious political issue. The development of the monasteries also meant that Rus acquired its own native literary class. The chronicles are written by the people of Rus, not by foreign missionaries, and they reflect local concerns rather than Byzantine views. Outside of the cities, we know even less about life in 12th century Rus. Archaeological finds suggest that not much had changed since we discussed agriculture back in the episode 18. The Slavs still mainly farmed in the forest steppe or forest zones. They had not moved into the black earth regions of the steppe, which were always vulnerable to attack from the Polovtsi. Villages consisted of extended family groups that used slash and burn techniques to clear land for cultivation, and periodically moved their fields to fresh land to maintain yields. Honey and wax were still important products. Hunting and fishing were essential to the food supply, and berries and mushrooms were foraged in season. The technological innovations that will improve ploughing and enable more productive arable farming are still some centuries into the future. In the next episode, we are going to jump back in time and look at the origins of the Polovtsi, or Kipchaks, as they called themselves, and we will start to refer to them. Further on in our story, the Kipchaks will form a significant part of the Golden Horde, and their language will form the basis for the Kipchak branch of the Turkic languages, including modern Karachay, Nogay, Bashkir, Kazakh, and Tatar. Thank you for listening, and until next time, goodbye.